There's not enough room in a greenhouse to grow food for 7.3 billion people.
With city populations set to explode in coming decades, some creative ideas are taking root about the future of urban farming.
What about a building that's 30 stories tall and half of a New York City block and footprint?
We're producing close to 20 million heads of leafy greens while using a fraction of the irrigation water.
We have thousands of sensors within this farm that are capturing information, and we're as much a big data company as anything else.
While using 100% renewable energy and producing over 150 jobs.
In 1 hour, they lost 5% of their farmland. So the Japanese government said, who knows how to grow food in another way?
We have plant biologists, plant physiologists, plant pathologists, molecular biologists, microbiologists. Those people also have a background in statistics.
With the Amazon of everything, when you unsubscribe to that co-op because it's the end of the year and subscribe to Amazon, the likelihood of you going back is very low.
So we're able to look at this data and understand really how to stress a plant to get different outcomes.
Imagine walking around inside your office with a tray, harvesting ingredients for lunch to hand over at the company cafeteria. How about a grocery store where the produce is growing upstairs? Or a 40-foot shipping container with 5,000 plants growing inside, even when it's snowing, outside. And that's what already exists.
This is the future of everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal.
From the newsroom in New York, I'm Jennifer Strong, and this is the future of everything. We begin in Brooklyn.
So we're about 40 feet up in the air, and we're in the middle of a very gritty former industrial neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York.
Viraj Puri is the chief executive of Gotham Greens.
So it's not typically the kind of neighborhood that you would imagine, a lush, fragrant lettuce and herb farm, but that is indeed where we are.
Gotham Greens operates rooftop greenhouses, including the world's largest, which is in Chicago.
We're producing close to 20 million heads of leafy greens while using a fraction of the irrigation water, eliminating any sort of fertilizer or pesticide runoff, which is a leading source of global water pollution, while using 100% renewable energy and producing over 150 jobs. So there's a number of wonderful tie-ins, both from an ecological perspective, a public health perspective, an economic development perspective.
The greenhouse we're standing in sits on top of a Whole Foods market. The plants are on tables about waist high, and there's a nice view of the Manhattan skyline. In terms of size, this is about a half an acre.
Yet it produces the yields of a farm that would be about 10 acres. So despite this being located on top of a supermarket, it actually provides produce to a lot of other supermarkets and neighborhood restaurants.
You won't find any dirt on this farm. All of the plants grow hydroponically, in water.
We selected this technology because it doesn't require soil, and cities often don't have good quality arable land or soil. And we also don't have a lot of area in cities, and this is a highly productive form of farming where you can achieve 20 to 30 times the yield compared to conventional farming.
More than half the world's population lives in cities, and UN research predicts that number could top 66% by 2050. Getting food grown far away into a city is a giant challenge, and one that's only going to get harder as populations grow. That's where urban farming comes in. Puri shows me how the system works.
We have irrigation water that's being drip irrigated into these long plastic channels, and a thin film of water and nutrients are running under the root zone. The plants are uptaking all those nutrients and water and dissolved oxygen. And then on the far side of the plastic channel, we're actually collecting the irrigation water for reuse. So the water is captured and recirculated and used over and over again, which is very efficient in how we can use about 10 times less water.
Not far from here is another leading urban agriculture company. Arrow Farms operates the world's largest vertical farm in industrial Newark, hidden away inside a former steel mill. Whoever decided New Jersey as the Garden State didn't have this place in mind. In the flight path of Newark Airport, it's so loud, freight trains fade into the background. Then you step inside. It's not just the change of scenery and sound that's dramatic, the smell. is radically different in here.
We don't use organic pesticides, organic herbicides, organic fungicides. We use zero.
David Rosenberg is the chief executive of AeroFarms.
The food is ready to eat without washing it. So we don't put chemicals on the plants, and so nothing touches the leaf structure.
But that's not why it smells like a forest.
Air in AeroFarms refers to aeroponics, so we aeroponically mist nutrition to the root structure. So there's a healthy oxygenation given the mist. Roots want oxygen, the leaves want CO2, so we also put in supplemental CO2 to the plants.
A very high-tech forest. Giant sheets of plants and lights tower overhead, and lifts are helping people harvest all the way up a dozen layers of these well-lit plants into the air.
We have thousands of sensors within this farm that are capturing information, and we're as much a big data company as anything else. We have plant biologists, plant physiologists, plant pathologists, molecular biologists, microbiologists, and those people also have a background in statistics. So we're able to look at this data and understand really how to stress a plant to get different outcomes.
It's safe to say I've never thought about what stresses a plant.
So we could influence vitamin A, B, C, D, antioxidants, again, just by stressing a plant.
So I asked Rosenberg to give an example.
You've heard, stand outside, get a little sun, increase your vitamin D. In a similar way, we could give different spectrum at different intensities, at different frequencies, or there are lots of other ways to stress a plant to maybe get it defensive, and it creates antioxidants. Then you have high antioxidants kale.
He says they also use this to control for texture and taste. But one of the criticisms of this method is the energy cost and consumption of all this lighting.
From a photosynthesis standpoint, we look to see what spectrum, at what intensity optimizes photosynthesis and what doesn't. And we're able to give the plants different spectrum, different intensities, and cut out wasteful spectrum. For example, yellow spectrum, which is the energy hog, there's very little yellow spectrum in here.
Back in the newsroom, I seek out some big picture perspective.
My name is Dixon DePommier. I'm an emeritus professor of public health and microbiology at Columbia University in the city of New York.
Otherwise known as the father of vertical farming.
We didn't call it vertical farming right away. We just called it indoor farming. And of course, everybody knows how to do that. It's a greenhouse. But what if there's not enough room in a greenhouse to grow food for 7.3 billion people?
His story goes something like this. His students want to study rooftop farming as a way to feed the future population of New York City. It's meant to be a feel-good project.
Picked the island of Manhattan to narrow the scope of the study, which had a population, I think, at that point of 2.2 million people. And then we calculated, based on the New York City maps of actual footprints of buildings, building by building, with flat roofs that were non-commercial, how much space there actually was to grow food into New York. And, of course, 2.2 million people, they each consume about 1,200 calories a day. Rice is probably the most energetic crop per bite. And so they grew rice on the rooftops of New York City, and they could feed 2% with all the rooftops filled with rice farms.
He says that's based on one crop per year on an open rooftop. But before we go any further, can you grow rice on a rooftop?
Yes. So I can show you a building in Japan. It's called Persona 02. They grow it in the foyer as you walk in the building. And it's real rice. You can harvest it. Like imagine working in this building. And then for lunch, you took an elevator to each of the floors up to the commissary. And you had a tray full of raw ingredients. And you gave it to a chef. And the chef says, wait 20 minutes and I'll make something for you. That's their life. This is a human resource building. But interspersed within the workspace, there are trellises that grow tomatoes and green beans, and the first floor is a rice farm.
As for those disappointed students, DePommier says he was looking at the Manhattan skyline when an idea hit him. What if urban vegetables were racked and stacked the same as urban people?
What about a building that's 30 stories tall and half of a New York City block and footprint? How many people could you feed then? Well, that was next year's project.
Vertical farming operations are cropping up all over the globe, but when they'll turn a profit, or what types of produce beyond salad greens will become sustainable products, remains to be seen. DePommier says the method often takes off out of a need, such as in Japan after the meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear plant in 2011.
In 1 hour, they lost 5% of their farmland. So the Japanese government said, who knows how to grow food in another way? And basically it turned out that they were already working on that at Chiba University, and then they just threw a lot of money at it. And the next thing you know, Toshiba and Panasonic and other companies were involved. And so it's growing food indoors on a large scale now. They're going to try to feed their whole country this way. Singapore has a similar phenomenon, and they have no space, basically. They have no land, but they're interested in food security. So this is how they get it. China has many, 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 many vertical farms. They're not talking.
I want to know what he thinks will become a standard of urban food production here in the U.S. He points to a prototype in Berlin of a grocery store concept by a company called InFarm.
On an electronic device of some sort, maybe get an iPad or something like this, you start checking off the things you want for tonight's dinner. And by the time you finish doing that and go up to the checkout counter, all of that produce in the 20-story building that is above the screen grocer come down either by dumbwaiter or some electronic device that delivers it in front of you, much to your amazement. And that's their vision for our supermarkets, so that there's no need for refrigeration. That saves an enormous amount of energy.
This professor in his mid-70s has enough cheerful energy to make anything seem possible. But what about the failures in this space? More than a few bright stars have come and gone or completely changed course. When it comes to vertical farming in particular, AeroFarm's chief goes so far as to predict that 90% of the players will fail within the next 3 years.
Failure is the route to success. Everybody knows that. But not for the ones that failed necessarily. It's an example of what not to do. You have to try very hard when you set up an industry, no matter what it is. You know, it's science. It's moved forward by results, regardless of what they are. So this didn't work, this didn't work, this didn't work. This worked. Okay, now stay with that. Now, when you get to the one that works, you spread out the parameters until it doesn't work. So you want to know what the limits are. Okay, and that's true when you do a scientific experiment. It's true when you grow food, test cars on a racetrack, or your cell phones, and to see how many times you can drop them before they break.
Among the trends observers are watching is the birth of urban farming accelerators. Kimball Musk, the brother of Elon Musk, is starting to build city campuses of mini vertical farms inside of shipping containers using the Freight Farms platform. Also, urban farmers aren't the only ones seeking greater efficiency or year-round growing seasons by adopting urban farming tech. Which brings us to where we leave this story for now. In the rolling hills of Pennsylvania, Pierre Conkret Jr. shows me around his family's farm.
This is birthing season. 3 out of the 4 goats just had their babies, and one more to go within the next 2 days. So we're on high alert. We've got a camera system here with infrared lights so we can see at night. And we've got like family watching the cameras so that I can sleep. And they alert me if they see something happening, and I run out here and take care of it.
This father-son duo, who introduced themselves as the Farmers Pierre, raise cattle, chickens, and dairy goats. But while the animals grow outside on pasture, the vegetables, those are growing inside, in a computerized shipping container with brilliant red and blue lighting.
Red and blue light. All over the snow, like a good 20 feet out, and the neighbors probably like, what are they doing over there? I mean, I always thought, I'm like, I wonder if they know. And I asked a few neighbors, I was like, do you know what that box is? And they go, is it like for the construction of the house? I'm like, no. They're like, well, what is it? I go, we're growing 700 heads of lettuce a week. They're like, no way. I'm like, what? Out of that box? Like, that's impossible. I'm like, it's pretty possible.
They do a booming salad business with local restaurants and grocery stores using the Freight Farms platform, a standard bearer of urban agriculture.
I mean, really, think about it. There are 256 towers, each growing 10 heads of lettuce. So you're at 2,560 heads of lettuce, plus each one of these holds 200. We've got at least 5,000 heads of lettuce right now growing in this little teeny box.
One person who can imagine it is John Friedman, president of Freight Farms.
With the Amazon of everything, when you unsubscribe to that co-op, because it's the end of the year, and subscribe to Amazon, the likelihood of you going back is very low.
Friedman co-founded Freight Farms to grow fresh food in cities. He says the company remains committed to that mission, but a growing part of the business comes from folks like the Farmers Pierre.
These operations have the connections, they have the output, they have the business model already set up. By growing throughout the winter, they not only get to obviously create more revenue, but they get to hold on to the business that they had each season.
Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Christopher Mims, Ruth Simon, Tanya Bustos, and Charlie Turner. I'm Jennifer Strong from The Newsroom in New York.
Oh, what? What's that? What is it? I knew that's what I was waiting for.
Top stories, timely insights. The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously.